There are 25 countries in the European Union, and those countries possess territories all over the world. So with an EU passport, you can get somewhere safe from just about anywhere. His potato head contains so much knowledge. That's why he was rich and I wasn't. So what does it take to get an EU passport? In response, he brought me to the balcony, where a short man with a round boyish face was talking on a cell phone. "Neil, I want you to meet Adam," Spencer said. Adam was the venture capitalist. He just got his Austrian citizenship this week. I definitely stumbled into the right place. While we waited for Adam to get off the phone, Spencer suggested devising a plan to select my second citizenship. He loved plans, which was fine with me, because I'd always been bad at them. It was hard enough for me just to leave the house without forgetting my keys or wallet. Spencer took a pad of paper, set it down on the coffee table, and numbered it from 1 to 5. By sorting through both practical necessities and personal preferences, we eventually selected 5 criteria required of the host country. 1. Must have a credible passport, providing a wide network of visa-free travel. 2. Must be politically and regionally stable, with a low crime rate. 3. Must not significantly increase the tax liability of Americans living there. 4. Must not require more than 2 years of residency for citizenship. 5. Preferably in a warm climate with beaches. Admittedly, the last criterion was more personal than political. Adam soon joined us. He reminded me of a thinner, better-groomed version of Ignatius J. Riley, the overweight mama's boy with an unwarranted superiority complex in the novel A Confederacy of Dunces. On the end table next to him, I noticed a book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers by Paul Kennedy, and made a mental note to buy it. "Neil wants to know how you got your passport," Spencer prompted him. "My passport?" Adam asked. "Anyone can get one." A smug smile spread across his face, like that of the only kid in the playground with a chocolate bar, if they invest over $1 million in the country. "But why Austria?" "It's the only place in the European Union that will give you citizenship for making an economic investment. I started a venture capital business there and hired a bunch of Austrians. It took forever to get approved. I had to go to the highest level of government. I didn't have that kind of money to invest, let alone those kinds of connections. It looked like the European Union was for the B-boys." "How long did it take to get it?" "I started trying as soon as Bush was re-elected," he replied. "Suddenly, I didn't feel so foolish. If the smartest, richest guys in the country were doing this, then clearly I wasn't paranoid. I was just ahead of the curve. A bunch of other B people are doing similar things right now," Spencer told me. "Do you know the Walton family? They own Walmart. They just built an underground bunker near their home in Arkansas. They even have a helipad in case they need to evacuate." That's crazy. It was amazing how little difference there was between the billionaires and the cult leaders. "Actually, it isn't. If something does happen in America, it may be difficult to get out," Spencer replied slowly, as if confiding a secret he hadn't meant to tell me. "So we're taking flight lessons in a few months." Spencer didn't start any business without researching every minute detail, then drawing up a schedule that looked forward at least 10 years, included all expenses, and had contingency options for every possible obstacle, including death. His escape from America plan was no different. "I'm not taking any chances with my family," he continued. "I just bought them guns in case we have to shoot our way to the airport." Coming from the mouth of a respected businessman, especially after watching the Flysian looting in New Orleans, these extreme preparations were actually beginning to sound reasonable, except for the guns. I couldn't imagine killing anyone. Unfortunately, as Betty the Goat knows, that lofty ideal of mine would fall by the wayside as the country continued its downhill slide. Lesson 15. The faster they rise, the harder they fall. Back in Los Angeles, I bought the book I'd seen at Spencer's house, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, by Paul Kennedy, which, from the first page, was eerily prophetic. Written in 1987, the book meticulously traces the histories and economies of world superpowers of the last 500 years. Its thesis, born of an endless array of historical examples, is that the collapse of every superpower in modern history has been due not just to lengthy fighting by its armed forces, but to its interest expanding internationally while its economy weakens domestically. In other words, empires collapse when they stretch themselves too thin. Furthermore, Kennedy explains, great powers in relative decline instinctively respond by spending more on security and thereby divert potential resources from investment and compound their long-term dilemma. Though he doesn't discuss America for most of the book, every word and every example has parallels in the United States today. For example, he writes of the declining Spanish Empire in the 16th century. Spain resembled a large bear in the pit, more powerful than any of the dogs attacking it, but never able to deal with all of its opponents and growing gradually exhausted in the process. Similarly, 200 years later, the British, like all other civilizations at the top of the wheel of fortune, could believe that their position was both natural and destined to continue. And just like all those other civilizations, they were in for a rude shock. As each successive empire fell on the same economic sword, Hegel's words kept echoing in my head. What experience in history teaches this, that peoples and governments have never learned anything from history. By the time I finished the book, it seemed clear that whether or not there was another devastating terrorist attack in America, the end of the empire as we know it was approaching. The only remaining questions were, would it simply become a smaller player, like Spain and Britain after their zenith, or disappear altogether, like Rome, Austria-Hungary, and the Soviet Union? And what world power would eventually take its place? China? The European Union? Maybe India? Either way, I was now convinced that, as surely as one tucks money into a retirement plan, I needed to build a backup life offshore immediately, and maybe even take Spencer's advice and look into other ways to protect myself. In a time when nuclear, chemical, and biological weapon technology is for sale to the highest bidder, especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of a great empire today could be a lot messier than in the past. After returning home from the Hamptons, I'd also called the lawyer Spencer had recommended, Holland Wright. Your client Spencer Booth and Adam McCormick recommended I speak to you, I told him, my voice slightly nervous, as it was every time I knew I'd have to say the next sentence aloud. I'm looking for a second citizenship, and wanted to see if I could work with you. That's not something I do, he replied brusquely. It's okay. I assumed he was just trying to protect his client's confidentiality. I was with them in the Hamptons this weekend. They told me to call you. No, that's not something I do, he repeated. Maybe I wasn't B enough for him. But is there anything else I can help you with? I hate lawyers. Thanks for your time. I hung up dejectedly. I needed to find someone who understood the advantages and disadvantages of each country, the benefits and restriction of each passport, the various legal shortcuts to obtaining quick citizenships. If necessary, I was even willing to consider getting married. But no lawyer would help me. As I boarded a plane to Mexico, I hoped someone at the Sovereign Society conference would have the answers I was looking for. I was running out of legal options. Lesson 16. How to protect yourself from inflation, hackers, and Celine Dion. A few words of advice. Never go to a conference of paranoid people looking for information. I've spent 15 years as a reporter. I've accidentally found myself swept up in riots, coups, and Kenny G concerts, and always gotten the story. But the Sovereign Society Offshore Advantage Seminar was no place for the casual question. The wide hallways outside the conference rooms of the Sheraton Hotel in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, were packed with middle-aged men and women. They weren't well-dressed, but they weren't badly dressed either. They weren't attractive, nor were they ugly. They didn't appear to be rich, but they didn't seem poor. What bound them together was that they all appeared inconspicuous. Unlike me, they weren't the type of people selected for random searches by airport security. Yet there was one thing that separated them from the rest of the guests at the Sheraton. They were alone. None appeared to be with spouses, children, or families. Their mission, and perhaps their life, was a solitary one, as was mine. I hadn't yet told my family or friends about what I was doing. As far as they knew, I'd gone to Mexico to surf, drink, and meet girls, which definitely would have been more glamorous. I looked around the hallway, at the pot-bellied man in the Hawaiian shirt, the greasy-haired woman in the blue business suit, the unshaven man in the Panama hat, and I wondered if they'd already escaped, and where, and when, and why, and how it went. But I would never know. Outside of a few pleasantries, no one would talk to me. None of the presentations that day were about obtaining a passport and fleeing America. The world of the Sovereign Society was much more involved than that. Thomas Fisher of Jyske Bank in Denmark urged attendees to keep their money offshore, where it wouldn't get confiscated by the government or lost in a lawsuit. Mark Seaton of Armor Technologies tried to sell computer privacy to prevent hackers from accessing private data. Chatsky and Associates urged attendees to open foreign trusts and LLCs to protect their assets. I looked over the schedule for the second day. Most were also about keeping money safe from high taxes, lawsuits, asset seizures, government regulations, and inflation. The paranoia here was different from mine. The members of the Sovereign Society were suspicious of the United States government. And while the events of the last few years compelled me to agree with them, I was equally worried about the suspicion other countries had of the U.S. government and the preemptive or retaliatory measures they might take against it. In short, they wanted to save their money. I wanted to save my skin. By the end of the day, I still hadn't made a friend or been in a discussion longer than 3 minutes. Some people seemed to know each other, but whenever I tried to join their conversations, they ignored me. By this point, I was pretty sure I was the most suspicious-looking person there. Though paranoia is often used as a derogatory term, the truth is that it's a survival instinct. If you think your postman is stealing your checks, or your nurse is poisoning your food, even if it's not true, the accusation is rooted in an innate desire for self-preservation. When a cat perks up its ears or hides under a bed when a completely harmless stranger approaches, it's the exact same response, developed through millennia spent living in the wild, where the unknown was a threat. And because the future is unknown, no matter how good or bad things may be today, it will always be a threat. So ultimately, the sole arbiter of what's paranoia and what's common sense is what happens tomorrow. You're only paranoid if you're wrong. If you're right, you're a prophet. Though the presenters were easy to mock, the next day I found myself picking up a flyer for Jyske Bank in Denmark from the conference information booth. If I was going to set up a new citizenship offshore, then I might as well put some money there to protect my savings against hyperinflation, bank failures, and lawsuits, just in case. By writing books and articles, I was exposing myself to litigation and violating one of the key principles of escape artists everywhere, privacy. The less people know about you, the less open you are to attack. I'd had many lawyers, including attorneys for Celine Dion and Michael Jackson, threaten me while I was at the Times. My friend Craig, who had recently received his silver cryonics wrist bracelet in the mail, had been sued by a former business partner. The litigation had wiped his bank account clean. He still had $150,000 in legal bills to pay, and the case hadn't even gone to court yet. Then there was my friend Frank, an internet marketer who used the wrong disclaimers on his website. He was consequently accused of running a pyramid scheme by the Federal Trade Commission, which seized every penny he had without filing a single criminal charge. I wasn't rich by any means, but it would still be cool if my net worth was zero. If I didn't own anything, then nothing could ever be taken away from me. The speakers had clearly gotten to me. We make fun of those we're most scared of becoming. As long as I was gathering intelligence, I grabbed a USB stick with information about Armor Technologies on it. Considering that I was about to take nearly every step the U.S. government and the IRS considered suspicious, it was time to protect my computer from prying eyes. As I turned to walk away, I noticed a short woman shuffle into the information booth. Her name tag identified her as Erica Nolan, president of the Sovereign Society. Maybe she would talk to me. "I need some help," I told her. "I want to get a second citizenship somewhere, and I was hoping you knew the easiest way to do this." She hesitated, as if weighing her options for escape, then relented. "What kind of places are you considering?" "I'm not sure, but it needs to be somewhere safe and with a credible passport that allows visa-free travel." "Well, I'm not an expert in all the different immigration laws." As soon as she said this, I wondered if I'd ever find what I was seeking. "But tomorrow there are two speakers you may want to see. One is Wendell Lawrence, who's here from St. Kitts. He used to be an ambassador there. The other is Ramsey Owens, who's going to discuss economic investment programs in Panama." "That's great," I replied. "But what I'm really looking for is an expert or a lawyer who knows the rules for every country and can discuss the pros and cons of each one." She nodded, as if she understood, and then lifted the tablecloth, reached underneath, and pulled a big blue book from a large stack. When I saw the title, I knew I had to own it. The Passport Book. The Complete Guide to Offshore Residency, Dual Citizenship, and Second Passports. This was my ticket out. Lesson 17. 5 Steps to a Tax-Free Life. That night, as I ate alone and friendless on the hotel restaurant patio, I cracked open the passport book. Travel documents have been around for centuries. At first they were letters from an authority, a king, a priest, a pharaoh, a landowner, allowing the bearer to travel unobstructed. While some argue that travel documents provide freedom, others maintain they've historically been used for control. By selectively granting and withholding them, governments have been able to regulate who enters and leaves their country. In the United States, outside of brief periods during previous wars, it wasn't until 1918, near the end of World War I, that the government began requiring everyone crossing the border to have a passport. "Is that the passport book?" Someone was actually talking to me. I looked up to see a thin man in baggy jeans and a short-sleeved green shirt. "Be careful with that," he warned. "The information goes out of date pretty quickly." Without hesitation, I blurted the question I'd wanted to ask every single person at the conference. "Do you already have a second passport?" "I was born in the UK," he replied, "but I moved to New Zealand when I was 10, so I already have 2 passports. But actually," a proud smile spread over his lips, "I don't consider myself a citizen of any country." I knew what this meant, because I had already come across it in my research. I had just met my first PT. "So you're basically PT," I asked. "Since 2000, he said, beaming. I couldn't believe he was opening up to me. Half a century ago, after serving in World War II, a newspaper publisher named Harry Schultz returned to America and was disappointed to find a nation of violent crime, high taxes, and frivolous lawsuits. So he sold his 13 newspapers and decided to become not a citizen of America, but a citizen of the world. The name he gave to this idea was PT. The letters don't stand for any 2 specific words, but most often they're defined as perpetual tourist or permanent traveler. The idea of PT is that just as we shop at different stores in a mall to find various items we want, we can also shop in different countries, to find the lifestyles, governments, careers, people, tax rates, and cultures that best suit us. So why stay in America just because you were born here? There's a great big world out there with a lot to offer. Just as every child must eventually grow up and leave home, just as our ancestors left the old world in search of the new, just as the hero of every great myth journeys outside the familiar, so too must we venture outside our small reality. And rather than simply believing we're living the best in the best of all possible countries, find out for ourselves. The PT at the hotel introduced himself as Greg and invited me to join him at his table. I sold everything, paid my tax bill, and told the New Zealand government I was leaving the country, he said, his cheeks flushed with pride. I was surprised to hear this, because New Zealand seemed like the safest English-speaking country left. What made you leave? I asked. I found myself in a bad situation. I'd lost all my money, including my house, so my son and I moved into a friend's home. I was about to start a day job teaching computer programming, but then I realized that the system was skewed against me. What do you mean? Like America, New Zealand has a progressive tax system. The more you earn, the higher your tax rate is. I realized that my dreams of getting ahead were up against the system that was going to penalize me for being successful. So I decided I wasn't going to stay there and be milked by the government, and I followed the PT course to remove myself legally from the system. Greg said he discovered the concept of PT after embarking on a libertarian reading jag. Ayn Rand's classic tome on capitalism and individualism, Atlas Shrugged, had led him to former Libertarian Party presidential candidate Harry Brown's influential How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. From there, he'd picked up This is the Way to the Stars, a workbook by the astrophysicist Andrew J. Galambos on how to build a society based on personal freedom. And this had led him to the writings of a man known by the pseudonym W.G. Hill. Do you have to be a libertarian to be PT? I asked. Where libertarians believe the best government is the one that governs least, I believed the best government is the one that governs best. Not at all, he replied, and then opened his computer and showed me a scanned copy of Hill's book, PT. The way to break free of nationality, according to Schultz's pamphlet, was to follow the three flag system. The three flags consist of having a second passport, a safe location for your assets in another country, and a legal address in a tax haven. To these, Hill added a fourth and fifth flag, an additional country as a business base, and a number of what he called playground countries in which to spend leisure time. Seems complicated, I told Greg. I couldn't wrap my head around the concept, perhaps because I wasn't really business savvy. My understanding of money was still primitive. You do work, you get paid for it, and you do your best to put some of that money in a bank. The core of PT, Greg explained patiently, is that if you're prepared to decouple from your home country, which is quite an emotional thing for most people, and not spend more than 180 days in more than one place, unless it's a tax haven, you can legally step outside of the obligation to pay income tax. The various flags are designed as a practical way of doing that. Though I have my own problems with taxes, they're too high, they're painful to pay, and too much of the money goes to defense contractors rather than domestic improvements, I understand their necessity. Unlike Thoreau in Civil Disobedience, I'm not going to just stop paying taxes and go to jail for it. If we weren't giving the government money to protect us, then there would be other people demanding protection money instead. So why not just pay the government, which is at least accountable to a degree, unlike, say, the mafia? You should get in touch with a guy called Grandpa in Monaco, Greg suggested after I blitzed him with follow-up questions. He's the archetypal PT. He might be able to help you. Before retiring to my room, I asked him why everyone else at the conference was so reluctant to talk. You have to be careful in this world, he explained. A lot of people get into PT because they're hiding from the law. Others get into it so they can scam folks who are desperate for passports or anonymity. Even the honest people are by nature private and distrustful. So it's a world of people trying to stay in the shadows. Good luck trying to get anyone else to talk. Why were you so nice to me then? Because I found the sixth flag. What's that? Freedom from fear. Lesson 18. Why knocking up a Brazilian woman can save your life. As soon as I returned to my hotel room, I tore the passport book open again and skimmed the nationalization requirements for each country, hoping for an answer. According to the author, several countries have loopholes that allow easier citizenships based on technicalities. For example, conceiving a child with a Brazilian woman, having a parent or grandparent who was a citizen of Ireland, proving a parent or grandparent was a German refugee during World War II, or having a Greek citizen for a father. Unfortunately, I had no relatives who were Irish or Greek. None of my German relatives were refugees, and I hadn't impregnated any Brazilian women lately. The easiest option was Israel, which grants citizenships after 90 days of residency, not just to all Jews, but to anyone who converts to Judaism. However, not only would Israel be the worst place to live if a major war broke out in the Middle East, but military service is compulsory for both men and women there. When I finished the passport book, I researched W.G. Hill online, then ordered electronic versions of three of his books. To my disappointment, I discovered that the expression, "In this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes," is true for Americans, making it nearly impossible to become a PT like Greg. After a 1994 Forbes article titled "The New Refugees" exposed a cabal of billionaires like Kenneth Dart, whose father invented the styrofoam coffee cup, and John Dorrance III, whose father invented condensed soup, that had expatriated to avoid taxes, Congress passed a law obligating most Americans who renounce their citizenship to continue to pay taxes for another 10 years, regardless of whether they re-enter the country or not. Another loophole allowed Americans to obtain a second citizenship, become a consul in their new home country, and then claim diplomatic immunity from U.S. taxes, but the government had made that impossible as well. In his book, Hill suggested a few workarounds, but they entailed never coming back to America or returning only under an alias, and I wasn't ready to make that sacrifice. All this research into escaping America was inadvertently making me appreciate it more. Not only was I unwilling to forsake the country permanently, but there wasn't anywhere else I was willing to live full time. As the sun rose outside my hotel window, I fell asleep discouraged, my head flooded with inconclusive data. I felt like I was living in a house with no doors. I was happy there, but if a fire broke out, I'd be burned alive. I needed an emergency exit. When I walked into the conference room late the next morning, a speaker was warning attendees that information on every bank transaction of more than $10,000 is sent to the U.S. Treasury to track potential financial crimes. I wondered how many people in the audience were actually wealthy enough to make all these asset protection and privacy efforts worth the effort. They seemed to be richer in fear than actual money. In the back row sat my first hope for escape, a bald, well-dressed Panamanian named Ramses Owens, Esquire. I approached and asked him about the requirements for citizenship in his country. He informed me that it would take 5 years to get a passport, though I could get an investor visa to obtain instant residency by investing $100,000 in a Panamanian business. I thanked him and moved on. I was hitting dead ends everywhere. On the other side of the room, Wendell Lawrence filled a folding chair. He was a big man, reminiscent of a slightly rounder and friendlier-looking Forrest Whitaker. He wore a gray button-down shirt, tucked into beige trousers, pulled high on his waist. Yet he wore the outfit so cleanly and properly that it seemed not like he'd pulled his pants up too high, but as if everyone else had let theirs drop too low. "Erica Nolan suggested talking to you," I said, meekly introducing myself. "Sit down," he replied in a deep Caribbean accent. I took a seat in the shadow of his bulk. Though he loomed over me, He wasn't intimidating. He was inviting. I felt safe, perhaps because of the way his eyes glittered with almost paternal friendliness. So what can I do for you? I wanted to see what steps I need to take to become a citizen of St. Kitts. Ah, he said, clapping his hands together. You'll love St. Kitts. It's a beautiful and small island with friendly people and real Caribbean culture. You should come for Carnival this year. He was like a living sales brochure, a very convincing one. He turned his seat to face mine and continued. If you're interested in living in St. Kitts, there are two ways to get citizenship. The fastest way is 3 months. It seemed too good to be true. There had to be a catch. As you may know, I didn't, of course. The sugarcane industry on the island collapsed. This year, the last sugarcane plantation closed. So, here was the catch. By investing in industries that will provide jobs to out-of-work sugarcane employees, you're granted citizenship instantly. The minimum investment used to be $100,000, but that just went up to $200,000. How long does it take to get that investment back? Wendell let out a long laugh. Oh no, you don't get the money back. So it's more like a donation. There's also another way, he continued. This is by investing in real estate. You must buy a piece of approved property that cost over $350,000. Can I live in it and sell it when I want? It's your home, but you have to keep it for at least 5 years to retain your citizenship. That sounded like a better deal, especially since wherever I went, I'd need a place to live anyway. Of course, I could have done it for free if I was willing to live somewhere long enough, but I was in a rush. To pay for it, I could always get a loan. This was back in the good old days, when mortgage companies gave interest-only loans to practically anyone who asked, no down payment necessary. How long does the citizenship process take? It takes longer than the investment program, about 6 months. I wanted to punch my fist jubilantly into the air, but I tried to contain my excitement. Not just out of decorum, but out of caution. I needed to talk to Wendell a little more and see if he and this program were for real. With pride, he told me about the island's high literacy rate. It's free medical care for children, senior citizens, and people with chronic diseases. It's public school system, which provides free textbooks and lunch for children, in addition to computer labs open to everyone on the island, and its status as a financial haven with no income tax for citizens. My new PT friend, Greg, would approve. Either Wendell was a genuinely good person with a heartfelt passion for his native country, or he was the best con artist in the room. That night, I called Spencer and excitedly told him about the St. Kitts real estate program. That seems like it could work, he replied. He sounded pleased, though not as excited as I'd hoped, especially considering he hadn't found any second citizenship options for himself yet. It would be great if we both had places there, he continued. I'll have my lawyer look into it. Your lawyer's an asshole. All lawyers are assholes, he replied. Between the conference and my conversation with Greg, I was beginning to realize that if anything went wrong in America, it would be nice to get out with not just my life, but my bank account. So I asked Spencer what he'd done with his money. I flew out to Switzerland and met with the different banks, he replied. I wanted to ask about their history during World War II and find out if they gave back the gold deposits they held for people fleeing the Nazis. A lot of banks never returned the gold to the refugees or their families. His thoroughness put the people at the Sovereign Society conference to shame. I met with a number of different ones, he continued, did some research, and went with a private bank that mostly deals with B people. But for you, I'd recommend AIG Private Bank. I asked him about asset protection, and he suggested a law firm called Tarasov and Associates that most of his friends used. I trusted his recommendations more than those of the speakers at the conference, who seemed to view safety more as a marketing niche than a personal right. I returned home, emboldened by a new sense of mission, and overwhelmed by the amount of work that lay ahead. I booked a trip to St. Kitts during Carnival in December, left a message for AIG to open a private banking account, emailed Grandpa for PT advice, and set up a meeting at Tarasov to hide my assets. It was a good start. Lesson 19. The Gone with the Wind Guide to Asset Protection. If you wanted to withdraw your entire life savings and move it to a bank in Switzerland, what would you do? Now that I'd decided to hide my assets offshore, the information from the Sovereign Society Conference about the government tracking withdrawals and transfers of more than $10,000 applied to me. It seemed impossible to get the money from my American bank to the Swiss bank Spencer recommended without ringing alarm bells. Even if I moved it in small increments, there would still be a paper trail detailing exactly how much money I transferred. So I did what any resourceful American would do. I bought a book on money laundering. After all, it isn't a crime to move money secretly, as long as the income's been reported to the IRS and any other necessary reporting requirements are met. And my intention wasn't to hide my earnings from the government, customs, or creditors, but to protect it from bank collapses, inflation, seizure, and lawsuits, which required leaving few traces of where it went. Securing money overseas is not a new idea. Even in the novel Gone with the Wind, Rhett Butler keeps his earnings in offshore banks, enabling him to buy a house for Scarlett O'Hara after the Civil War, in contrast to his Southern colleagues, who lose their fortunes due to blockades, inflation, and financial collapse. For more practical, non-fictional inspiration, I bought Jeffrey Robinson's 1996 book, The Laundrymen. I'd always wondered how empty video stores renting movies for $3 a day could stay in business, and why I'd see Russian thugs running clearly unprofitable frozen yogurt stands on deserted side streets. According to Robertson, it's because, in order to make illegal funds appear legitimate, crooks will slowly feed the money into the cash registers of a normal business. It's almost impossible, he writes, to spot an extra $500 coming in daily through the tills of a storefront stocked with 15,000 videos. Nor would anyone's suspicions necessarily be raised if that same owner ran a chain of 20 video rental stores and, backed up with the appropriate audits, awarded himself an annual bonus of $3.96 million. Buried elsewhere in Robinson's book was the answer I was looking for. The best legal way to surreptitiously move money, it seems, is to buy something that doesn't lose its cash value when purchased. For example, there's a black market for people who transfer money by buying expensive jewelry, art, watches, and collectibles, then selling them in their destination country for a small loss, usually no greater than the percentage banks charge for exchanging currencies. So once AIG Private Bank in Switzerland returned my phone call, assuming that, unlike Spencer's lawyer, they were actually willing to work with me, I planned to go shopping for rare coins. But if it was all so legitimate, why did it feel so wrong? While I waited to hear from the Swiss bank, I drove to Burbank to meet with the asset protection lawyers Adam and Spencer had recommended, Tarasov and Associates. The receptionist led me into a room with black and silver wallpaper where Alex Tarasov sat at a large mahogany desk with a yellow legal pad in front of him. With this pad, he would rearrange my business life forever. "You did a very smart thing by coming here," Tarasov said. 25 years ago, he had probably been a frat boy, maybe even played varsity football. But a quarter century spent sitting at desks scrutinizing legal papers had removed all evidence of health from his skin and physique. "By taking everything you own out of your name, we can hide it from lawyers trying to do an asset search on you," he continued. "So if they sue me and win, they won't be able to get anything. We can make it very difficult for them to find the things you own and get at them. It's not impossible, but the deeper we bury your assets, the more money it's going to cost to find out where they are. And if we can make that time and cost greater than the worth of the assets, then you're in good shape." As Spencer had once told me, this was just insurance. The cost of setting this up would be like taking out a policy against lawsuits. "So what do you own?" he asked. I laid it all out for him. "I have a house I'm still paying for. I have some stocks and bonds my grandparents gave me when I was a kid. I have a checking and a savings account. And I have the copyrights to my books. I paused, trying to remember if I owned anything else. I thought there was more. I guess that's about it. I have a second-hand Dodge Durango, I guess. And a 1972 Corvette that doesn't work. In truth, I didn't own that much. But ever since my first college job, standing over a greasy grill making omelets and grilled cheese sandwiches, I had started putting money in the bank. Since then, I'd saved enough to live on for a year or two, if I ever fell on hard times, or just wanted to see the world. I didn't want to lose the freedom that came from having a financial cushion and not being in debt for anything besides my house. If we can wrap everything in an LLC, Tarasov explained, and then all those LLCs are owned by a holding company. And that holding company is owned by a trust that you don't even technically own, then you're safe. I liked that last word, but I didn't understand the rest of it. So we're just basically making everything really complicated, I asked. That's the idea. We'll even put your house in a separate LLC, so that if someone trips and falls, they can't get at anything else you own. When Tarasov was through explaining everything, I couldn't tell whether I was protecting myself from being scammed or actually being scammed myself. But I trusted Spencer, because he seemed too rich, too smart, and too paranoid to get taken in. So I told Tarasov to start wrapping me up in LLCs until my net worth was whatever spending money I had in my pocket. Once we have all these entities set up, we can talk about transferring them to offshore corporations, Tarasov said as I left. It sounded exciting, though I worried that by the time he was through charging me for all this, I wouldn't have any money left to hide. Either way, my net worth would still be zero. My next order of business was long overdue, to make my computer as secure as possible. That is, if my internet searches for second citizenship options and private Swiss banks hadn't already caught the government's attention. For this, I enlisted the help of Grandpa. He had responded instantly to the email I sent after the Sovereign Society conference and, like a true money-minded PT, tried to sell me a series of books he wrote, Bye Bye Big Brother, for the bargain price of $750. Fortunately, I found a much cheaper abridged version his publisher was selling online. In combination with a few internet resources, I used the chapter titled Secure Internet Communications as my primer on computer safety. I spent an entire day downloading and installing encryption programs, firewalls, spyware destroyers, and a software from torproject.org that supposedly enabled me to surf the internet without being traced or tracked. Eventually, I hoped to use two computers, one solely for going online, and a second laptop with all my data, but no means of connecting to the internet. Though Grandpa's computer advice made me feel more secure, my long email correspondence with him fanned other flames of paranoia. Convicting someone who's taking the steps you are would bring glory to some little assistant DA or federal attorney, he warned. The way out is not necessarily leaving at once, but just be ready to move ass and assets at the first whiff of shit coming your way. I thought back to a year earlier, when I felt like my life and livelihood were at the mercy of terrorists, the government, and the economy. Though those threats had grown even worse since then, I had become stronger, more stable, more informed, more resilient. All I needed to do now was visit Wendell and St. Kitts. Then I'd truly be able to leave when, as Grandpa put it, the first whiff of shit came my way. I was almost free. But, as Spencer continued to remind me every time we spoke, I still wasn't safe. Lesson 20. How to alienate your family in 60 seconds or less. Were you ever scared during the Cold War that something bad would happen to you or your family? I asked my father. Not really, he replied. I'd say that right now is the scariest time I've been alive. Considering that my father had lived through World War II and the Cold War, in addition to serving as an army lieutenant in Korea. His answer gave some legitimacy to my concerns. "Why is it scarier now?" I asked him. "In the Cold War, because of mutually assured destruction, you didn't think about the Russians sending their nuclear things over. But now, with terrorists, you don't know what's going to happen. They've killed innocent people everywhere on the planet. So it's scary at home, and it's scary when you travel. Nothing's safe anymore." I'd stopped in Chicago to have dinner with my parents on the way to St. Kitts, not just to tell them about my escape plan, but to see if they wanted to be included. "If you want," I offered, "I can look into adding family members to my citizenship application. This way, if anything happens in America, you have somewhere safe to go." "We're fine," my mom said, dismissing the proposal as quickly as she dismissed most of my ideas, jobs, and girlfriends. "So you don't want me even to check for you?" I asked, disappointed. "Ask your father." "I don't see the point," my dad said. "We're happy here." "Are you sure? I mean, you just said you were scared." I wanted to give them another chance. Most people mistake comfort and familiarity for safety. "Not until the flames are licking the rooftop will they leave. And even then they'll dawdle, trying to grab every last memento and stuff it into their car, as if their possessions held the very essence of their identity. I'll do the work. All you need to do is sign the papers." "Just leave us out of it," my mom said. The conversation was over. "Okay, well, if you're ever in trouble, you can come stay with me anyway." I'd wondered at times why I seemed to be the only one of my friends pursuing safety so voraciously. As I sat with my parents, I realized that it was in part because of my upbringing. My parents were worst-case thinkers and used to constantly warn me about everything that could go wrong when I grew up and left home. They also practiced what they preached. When we went on vacation, my brother and I weren't allowed to tell our friends so that no one knew our house was empty. And we'd leave for the airport in shifts. My father and I would take a taxi as my mother and brother pretended to say goodbye, and then they'd follow in another cab shortly afterward. While we were gone, the house lights were hooked up to timers, so they'd go on and off as if we were still there. In short, I was raised in a world where strangers were enemies and privacy meant protection. As my father always told me, expect the best, but prepare for the worst. "You know what you might find interesting," my father said, playing peacemaker. "There's a book that came out when everyone was scared of the Russians. Someone bought it for me as a joke. It tells you how to build nuclear shelters and radiation suits." "I'm not that paranoid," I told him, then added, "Do you still have it?" "I'm pretty sure I threw it away, but it was called Life on Doomsday, or something like that." After dinner, I went online and found the book, which was actually called Life After Doomsday. The author, Bruce Clayton, had written it during the tail end of the Cold War, and it quickly became somewhat of a Bible for the burgeoning survivalist movement. He'd also written a sequel in response to 9/11, Life After Terrorism, which I ordered as well. Spencer's obsession with guns, planes, and his latest and most outlandish escape plan, submarines, kept echoing through my head. Later that night, I asked my brother if he wanted to get a second passport with me. At first he declined, saying he was worried there'd be negative consequences. After I reassured him, he said he didn't have the money for the citizenship, so I told him I'd take out a loan and help pay it off for him. Then he flatly declined. I was alone. There is a phenomenon known as social proof. It's the idea that if everyone is doing something, whether it's buying a certain pair of shoes, seeing a particular movie, or criticizing some unfortunate individual, it must be right. So if no one else was trying to escape the country besides me, then it must be wrong. The problem with that logic is that by the time everyone is doing it, after the next terrorist attack, or economic depression, or political clampdown, or epidemic disease, it will be too late, and those who want to escape will be left trying to barter money, sex, connections, and everything else they have, just for the privilege of living. Lesson 21. Proof that a fool and his money are soon parted. It was here, in the streets of Basse-Terre, where the debris of Carnival rotted in the sun, and teenage boys leaned against the same peeled paint walls their fathers once did, that I would make my stand. In the center of Market Street sat the office of Maxwell Webb and Partners. My entire plan rested solely on his shoulders, and until just 2 hours earlier, I'd never even heard his name. Maxwell greeted me at the door, alone in the office. He shouldn't even have been here during Carnival. He made sure to remind me of that, several times. I wanted to trust him, because I had to, but the diamond-encrusted ring on his middle finger, emblazoned with the initials MW, told me not to. It told me that he wanted to be respected, to be considered a player, to chase status in women. And in a poor town of 15,000 people, that wasn't difficult. A ring like that was probably all it took. And I was about to contribute $2,500 toward his next ring. He sat down heavily in front of a large walnut desk, covered with thick file folders. He knew why I was there, but it appeared I must tell him anyway. "So how does the process work?" I asked. When I'd first arrived in St. Kitts, Wendell had told me what needed to be done. But he'd sent me here, to this office, to this stranger with the expensive ring, to get it done. And I needed reassurance. I had no idea if this move was smart and prescient, ultimately saving my life and hopefully that of my family, or if it was the stupidest thing I'd ever done, a testament to paranoia that would end in my own bankruptcy. "You'll need some property," Maxwell said. "You can call Victor Doche at St. Christopher Club, Ron Fish at Half Moon Bay, or Nicholas Brisbane at Calypso Bay." The office fan spun uselessly above his head, circulating heat, as he read their numbers to me from the local telephone directory. I asked about other options. I wanted to think carefully about this, but he told me I had no other options. He was right. "Once you pay the $2,500 retainer fee," he explained, "I'll give you the papers you need to fill out." I didn't like him. I wanted someone to hold my hand, to explain things rather than just tell me what to do. I like to understand something before committing to it. I don't think that's wrong. But either Maxwell wasn't the talkative type, or he saw that I was by no means the kind of person he'd want to align with. His walls were filled with framed letters, photographs, and certificates, testifying to the high opinion he wanted others to have of him. But I didn't smell like money and power and a thick file folder and a photograph to put boastfully on the wall. I smelled like the inside of an airplane, economy class, middle seat. "How many of these cases do you take a year?" I asked him, looking for some reason, any reason, to have faith in him. 10, he said. "And how many applications does the government take each year?" "About 100. 99% of them get through." So Maxwell handled 10% of the traffic. That was reason enough for me. I wrote him a check for $2,500. He handed me a sheaf of papers. One was an application for citizenship. The other was an application for a passport. In 6 months, Maxwell told me, if all went well, I would officially be a citizen of the Federation of St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean Commonwealth. Spencer's words burned in my ears. I was buying insurance. Insurance against America, the country I was born in, the country my friends and family live in, the country I love. This wasn't supposed to happen in my lifetime. Lesson 22. The Art of Disappearing. The next day, I woke up early, found a taxi, and went house shopping. The driver's name was Chiefy. He was a short, jolly Catitian, with a smile designed to win the trust of tourists. Most of the land in this spot was owned by a Russian gangster who couldn't get citizenship anywhere in Europe, he informed me as we swerved around a large green hill. Every time he spoke, he turned around to make eye contact, which would have been polite if it weren't for the narrow lanes and tight turns of the coastal road. Except that hill right there, he went on. That's owned by a Saudi Arabian criminal who stole his son from his ex-wife and brought him to America. He bought the property in exchange for a diplomatic passport so he could safely get to the States and back to see his son without being extradited. And so began a tour of the checkered past, promising future, and eccentric characters of the island that might one day be my home. Discovered by Christopher Columbus in 1493, St. Kitts was united with a neighboring island, Nevis, 4 centuries later, to become the smallest country in the Americas.